from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, taps for the Iraq War, deal time in Congress, Mitt and Newt tangle, the EU teeters on. On Capitol Hill, jujitsu, battle cries, then talk of a truce. Here's House Speaker John Boehner.
Look, I've been here for a while. This is not the first time I've seen year-end work get knotted up. But I think everyone just needs to step back and take a deep breath.
Down to the wire, and Iowa, Mitt Romney sharpened his attacks on the here unnamed Newt Gingrich.
Zany is not what we need in a president. Zany is great in a campaign. It's great on talk radio. It's great in the print. It makes for fun reading. But in terms of a president, we need a leader.
And U.S. armed forces folded their colors in Baghdad. President Obama spoke to returning warriors at Fort Bragg.
On behalf of a grateful nation, I'm proud to finally say these two words, and I know your families agree. Welcome home. Welcome home. Welcome home.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Zanny Mitten-Beddoes of The Economist, Susan Davis of USA Today, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What do you say on the war's end, the troops, Mitt and Newt and Bachman and Ron Paul, Time Magazine's Person of the Year, the protester? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Susan Davis is with us from Washington. She's chief congressional correspondent for USA Today, and boy, do we need her explanations. Hello, Susan.
Hi, Tom.
From Washington as well, Zanny Mitten-Beddoes joins us, economics editor for The Economist. You can't get more economical than that. Zanny, welcome back. It's great to have you.
Hi, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, we're joined by Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Zanny, and Susan.
Susan, take us in here, if you will. I don't even know how to disentangle all these pieces and what's going on. For most of the week, it looked like some kind of sumo match where it was all political posturing to make the other party look bad. Do we really have everybody holding hands now? What's going on?
This was a good week that was sort of emblematic of how this entire year in Congress has been, in the sense that the two parties often agree broadly on what the end goal is and what they need to do. They just can't agree on the path to get there. And that was the case this week. In a late hour deal announced last night, on Thursday night, the government's not going to shut down. The current funding of the government will run out Friday, December 16th at midnight. Congress is expected to pass on Friday a $915 billion bill that bundles together nine spending bills that will fund the government through September 30th, which is the fiscal year. So we won't be talking about shutdown again until September of 2012, most likely.
On the eve of the election. So the government goes on. We'll unpack that a little bit. What about the pieces that have had so much attention in the last couple of weeks, the payroll tax exemption, the unemployment insurance? Where does that stand?
This puzzle has not yet been solved, but there is progress in the direction of either a short-term deal to extend the payroll tax cut holiday and unemployment benefits, as well as a package that would head off Medicare cuts to doctors. But they can't agree on how to pay for it. And that has been sort of the overarching debate of this Congress, is how does government pay for what it wants to do, whether it's cutting spending or tax cuts or tax increases. And the divide between the party is just so great. So it looks like either they're going to have to extend it through the year, through 2012, through the end of 2012. It would be a one-year extension. But they haven't gotten to the math of how to pay for it. The long-term package is about $220 billion. Mm. And they can't agree on what we would call pay-fors. But, you know, if you want to spend the money, you either need to cut spending or raise the taxes to balance the books.
I mean, I thought the pay-for issue was the deal-breaker here. Is this all just being sort of fuzzed and muddled up so they can go home for the holidays? Or what's going on?
I think that there is part of that. They can't agree on the long term. So in the short term, they're looking at potentially extending the payroll tax cut, which affects about 160 million Americans. It's mm-hmm. a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And it's estimated to affect about $1,000 annually for the average American family.
Right.
So it's a good bit of money, especially in a tough economic time. So the majority of members of both parties, they want to extend it. They understand at Christmas, they don't want to go home. They don't want the message to be Congress is going home at Christmas and has failed to extend
Doesn't
a
care.
Tax cut.
Yeah.
That's going to affect millions of mm-hmm. middle-class Americans. So in the meantime, what it might be is that this is a Congress that punts. They haven't been able to really address the presiding issues of the day, being the federal debt, the federal deficit. So they may craft a short-term deal that will get them into early next year, and we'll start this fight all over again.
And unemployment insurance for listeners who may depend on that, or others who know family members who do at this moment, who just can't find a job, where does that end up in this
It would be tied to the payroll tax cut. So, and this is another great example of why I'm inclined to think they will get it done before they adjourn, because if Congress left town and didn't do this, around January 7th, January 10th, certain people who rely on unemployment benefits to get by right now, their checks would stop coming. And that can't be minimized in both either in the practical terms of how it would affect people and in the political. You know, it's not it would not be politically palatable to either party to do that right now. So whether it's most likely going to happen, whether it's going to be 2 months and we're having this fight all over again next year, or they're able to get it through 2012, then we'll probably be having this fight again at the end of 2012.
Zanny, I want to come to you on the fight on the other side of the pond. But first, Jack Beatty, to you on the politics of this incredible week of maneuvering in Congress. What do you see going on here? I mean, on the one hand, there's so much Republican hue and cry to just bring that deficit down and don't be spending more and don't be giving away, the Social Security payments that need to go into that fund and all the rest. On the other, Democrats thought they were onto the sweet issue for them ever if they could get Republicans to vote against this, as the dust just begins to clear here. Jack, what do you see?
Well, as you say, it's muddled. It's ambiguous dust. And I think each party is going to retire to its corner and try to figure out the next step. NPR asked the Republican Party, asked Republican senators and legislators to produce a millionaire, to produce one person, a small businessman, netting more than $1 million a year.
Who would be hurt by the tax
on millionaires. And at my last recollection, no such person has been brought forward.
But the Democrats have stepped down from asking for
that. They have indeed. And you have people like Bernie Sanders. I saw him last night, the Vermont Independent, throwing up his hands and saying, we've lost this terrific issue. Well, of course, they've got to balance things, don't they? Mm. If they keep the issue, and they won't get their payroll tax cut. And if they don't get the payroll tax cut, the economy will be hurt. And if the economy is hurt, the president's reelection chances will be damaged.
So on we roll. Zanny Mittenbettos, take us across the Atlantic. It's over there, but we all know that as Europe wobbles along, if it falls, that could come crashing back here. You've got Christine Lagarde warning on the front page of the Financial Times today, we could be back in a 1930s style re-slide into recession, depression, you name it. Where does it stand after all these weeks of struggle to get on top of this thing? What's the status now, Zanny, with Europe's euro crisis?
Well, it's not looking very good. I mean, Susan said that Congress had not had a terrific year. I think that things are much, much worse on the European side of the Atlantic. The Europeans have had a strategy, really. Well, I'm not sure you can even call it a strategy, but they have had an approach all year of muddling through, of trying to do the minimum amount at the last minute to solve the euro crisis, and it hasn't worked. The crisis has rumbled on. It's got much, much more intensive. And people are now really questioning whether, in fact, the whole Eurozone will survive. And there was a big summit a week ago, which was deemed to be the summit at which the whole crisis would be solved. It wasn't. The crisis continues. And now the European economies, one by one, are tipping back into recession. Next year is going to be much, much tougher. It's going to be an environment of austerity making recessions worse, bank credit tightening, things looking ever grimmer, and unfortunately yet no clear route through this.
And of course, that can all bite the U.S. and bite it in a big way. Just a week ago, everyone was looking as David Cameron, the conservative British prime minister, had sent the signal that Britain was not going to join in the solution. He came under big attack, but responded sharply on that this week. Here's opposition Labour Party leader Ed Miliband. This was on Monday in the House of Commons. Harsh words for David Cameron, the Prime Minister, saying his veto of the EU treaty or Britain's peace in it was a catastrophic mistake.
The reality is this. He has given up our seat at the table. He has exposed, not protected, British business. And he has come back with a bad deal for Britain.
Here's Cameron hitting back, saying he questioned whether Miliband himself supported the new EU steps.
He can't tell us whether he's for it or whether he's against it. Has it got enough safeguards in, or has it got too few safeguards? Would a Labour government back it, or would you veto it? If the answer is yes, he should have the courage to say so. If the answer is no, he should have the honesty to say that I was right to keep Britain out of it.
It can all sound a little Monty Python-y over here, but it's not. What does it mean that the UK said, no, we're not joining this new step, Zanny?
Well, what happened was the UK is, as you know, a member of the European Union, but it's not a member of the Eurozone. Mm-hmm. And what the Eurozone countries want to do as part of their solution to solving the crisis is to have a new treaty that kind of enshrines in European law the steps they want to take for sort of tougher fiscal rules and tougher monitoring of fiscal rules. And although that wouldn't have applied to the UK because the UK isn't in the Euro, the British were very worried about a treaty change because they thought that that might down the road allow changes to rules that would adversely affect the City of London.
I.e. the financial sector, their Wall Street.
They're worried about their Wall Street. It's a huge part of the British economy. And certainly the French are more inclined to regulate and control markets than we British are comfortable with. And David Cameron was in a tough political spot because the British are many British are very skeptical about the whole EU project. Mm. They see what's going on the other side of the English Channel. They think they're very glad they're not part of the Euro. And his party in particular, the Conservative Party, is extremely skeptical of Europe. And so it was going to be very hard for him to come back from this summit in Brussels to say that he'd signed up to a treaty change. But what I think is important to know is that this whole very dramatic episode with Britain was really a sideshow to the bigger issue last week, which was that the Europeans actually failed to come up with a clear strategy for saving the euro themselves. This was supposed to be a summit about saving the euro. Yeah. It was dominated by a sort of argument with the UK about whether the UK would be part of this process or not.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a big week in the news. Pulling out of Iraq. Deal time in Congress. Last debate in Iowa for the GOP contenders. Europe wobbles on for now. Susan Davis is with us, chief congressional reporter for USA Today. Zanny Mitten-Beddoes is here, economics editor for The Economist. And our own Jack Beattie is here. You can join the conversation. Leon Panetta, defense secretary in Baghdad at that flag-furling ceremony that we all heard and saw this week, marking the official end of the U.S. mission in Iraq. Small, quiet ceremony, little brass quintet there. He spoke with the troops.
You came to this land between the rivers. Again and again. And again, you did not know whether you'd return to your loved ones. You will leave with great pride, lasting pride, secure in knowing that your sacrifice has helped the Iraqi people begin a new chapter in history.
Maybe that's true. We hope so. But there are many things unclear at this point. President Obama was at Fort Bragg, marking the end of the nearly nine-year-long war in Iraq. Said America is stronger, the world more secure because of that service. But listen, you know, there's no real firm bottom line in here.
The war in Iraq will soon belong to history. Your service belongs to the ages. Never forget that you are part of an unbroken line of heroes spanning two centuries. From the colonists who overthrew an empire, to your grandparents and parents who faced down fascism and communism, to you, men and women who fought for the same principles in Fallujah and Kandahar, and delivered justice to those who attacked us on 9/11.
Delivered justice to those who attacked us on 9/11. Wow, I mean, this comes pretty close to George W. Bush. I'm not sure what to make of it. Jack, I really want to hear you on this, but let me start, Susan Davis, with you in Washington, sitting in the middle of Congress with everything going on as the U.S. troops sort of wrap it up in Iraq. Is this a tree that falls in the woods and nobody hears? Were people paying attention? It's been so long, it almost drifted off the national page, even though so much blood and treasure spent there, Susan.
It did not go unnoticed, but it was very quiet. Normally on Thursdays, the leaders of the parties often have press conferences. And John Boehner, I think if he mentioned it at all, mentioned it only in passing and focused instead on the spending bills and the payroll tax cut. Nancy Pelosi, a liberal Democrat who was one of the most vocal opponents of the war and one of the most vocal opponents of George W. Bush, did devote some time. But there's a hesitancy, I think, in both parties to either declare it a victory or a defeat. The terms are not black and white on Iraq, particularly not from a lawmaker standpoint, particularly as we talk about it in terms of what it cost us, both in terms of men and women and financially. The cost of the wars has been directly related to the debate we're having in Washington right now over the fiscal health of the country. So it's muddled. There is no clear cut answer on there was no press conferences, there was no grand displays on Capitol Hill to mark the end of it.
Kind of amazing. A trillion or two or three or four, depending who you listen to and how far out you project. Zanny Mittenbeddoes, how do you see the impact of all these years and blood and American treasure spent here on American standing in the world? Can you put a barometer to it, Zanny?
I think it's fundamentally changed American standing in the world. I think that the Iraq War epitomized, American American bravado in at the very beginning, then kind of a lot of incompetency, then some terrible things that, you know, for outside this country are still very, very high in people's memories, Abu Ghraib and all of that. And now I think a kind of quiet farewell. Iraq is a new chapter. I think that's a very accurate description. Iraq does face a new chapter, but it's a very uncertain one. And so now there's a lot of question about what happens in the region, what happens with Iran, what happens, is there a vacuum there? So I think the rest of the world has a different view of the U.S., and also that the U.S. is itself much less inclined to be the policeman of the world, if you will, and that has obviously had a huge effect on the rest of the world. So, yes, it epitomizes a very big change, both in America's own perception of what it should be doing and the rest of the world that has occurred over the past 9 years.
Jack Beatty, this show's existence more or less fills the exact same set of years as the Iraq War. We came on just before after 9/11. You and I have been talking about this since well before and all the way through. And here we are at the end, and there's something kind of out-of-body quality to this. So glad to see those families reunited as the soldiers come home. But how do you see the big picture here, Jack?
Well, Tom, here are three quick lessons of Iraq, I think, useful to recall as American opinion really is being worked on to attack Iran. One, we have evolved a culture and politics of war in America. Bias toward force persists, even though we won the Cold War without firing a shot. Politicians, and I include the president, appeal to this culture. When to sound tough on Iraq, they beat the dead horses of language. Tough on Iran, they beat the dead horses of language from Iraq. Strategic threat, menace to its neighbors, madman ruler. Newt Gingrich is recycling to Iran the canard from Iraq that Saddam would hand off his weapons of mass destruction to terrorists. Mitt Romney vows Iraq will not get nukes on his watch.
You're talking Iran now, Jack. Iran, not Iraq.
Iran, yes. Mm-hmm. Only Ron Paul says we can deter a nuclear Iran. And although John Abizaid, the general, concurs with Paul, Bigfoot pundits dismiss him. Sense gets repackaged as weakness by the votaries of the culture of war. Second, beware can-do generals. All reportedly were appalled at the small size of the force Secretary Rumsfeld sent to Iraq, yet only one quit in protest as ambition overrode judgment and concern for the troops. And three, on Iran, as on Iraq, fear of the L word will drive opinion leaders to sprout hawkish feathers. Les Gelb, the former president of the Council on Foreign Relations, has said that he supported the Iraq War lest he be marginalized as a liberal critic. He was not. He is not alone in media world. Yet liberal Cassandras like Wayne Morse and George McGovern were right about Vietnam, just as liberals like Ted Kennedy and Tom Harkin were right about Iraq. In Washington, liberal is a synonym for irrelevant. History suggests that, regarding wars at least, it should be a synonym for wise.
Well, maybe, though. There were people all over the voting count on this one, and some who said no, but many, many, many in that Democratic column who said yes. We're still living with the outcome of this era of war and war on terror, big defense spending act going through this week, the National Defense Authorization Act, which way down in the weeds okays military detention for terrorism suspects. And in this country, here's lawyer and civil rights activist Glenn Greenwald appearing on the web TV show The Young Turks to say this was disturbing, just taking this sort of war on terror status quo forward.
The fact that Congress is now creating a law that specifically says the government can put you in military detention for as long as it wants, or that it charges of any kind, is an extremely pernicious and dangerous thing for sure. But our status quo under the Obama and Bush administrations is already so radical in terms of these powers that the reality is it doesn't change all that much.
The Iraq War ends, but elements of the time we've lived through going straight forward. Laura Murphy here with the ACLU in Washington says the last time Congress passed indefinite detention legislation was during the McCarthy era, and President Truman had the courage to veto that bill. The Obama White House originally threatened that, but then said, oh, we're all right with this. Mike in Evansville, Indiana. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. There's a connection between the Iraq War and the economy that just seems to not be explored. Historically, private wealth spikes after a war. It's always been that way, starting with privateers and letters of marque. We talk about trillions being spent on the war, but I have no idea where it went. We didn't pile it up and burn it. We didn't mold cash into airplanes. Follow the money. It's maybe a dirty little question, but who profited? Where did this money go? We've got this big slump in the economy, yet this public money was transferred to the private sector. What happened to it?
Let us pick it up, Mike, and I appreciate your call from Indiana. I'll get one more from Brenda in Aiken, South Carolina, and come straight to it. Brenda, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I rejoice for the soldiers who have come home, but our military operations there are not over. Nobody's talking about the mercenaries that are left behind. We don't know how many there are. I think the president said 50,000, but who knows?
You're talking private contractors working for the U.S. There in Iraq.
Exactly. We don't know what they cost because, to my knowledge, that money is not in the budget. Somebody can correct me if I'm wrong. What are they doing? They're over there on their own. They're unaccountable to anyone, not our military, not our government. I believe the operations now are illegal. At least the Iraq War was technically legal because Congress approved it. I don't believe Congress has ever approved the use of the mercenaries.
Brenda, I appreciate your call. We've all learned to be skeptical about what's going on that front. I don't know about the exact number. 50,000 sounds high, but there will certainly be private contractors there as the U.S. troops pull out. Susan, let me come first to you on Mike's money question from Indiana. You know, people are saying $800 million, a trillion, long-term maybe $4 trillion. But in terms of cash in already, where's that money, Susan? Is Mike right? Was this a bonanza for somebody?
Well, I mean, certainly there are people that defense companies profit when we go to war. But I do think, you know, war's expensive. Soldiers are expensive. Equipment is expensive. So if you look over the course of the wars, there was certainly coverage about money that went missing in mm-hmm. Afghanistan and Iraq. And there is no question that there is financial corruption when enterprises that large are undertaken, particularly when you involve people outside the military command, as your other caller said, subcontractors, people that are involved in the business of war. I'm not sure I would say, I think it's a stretch to say $1 trillion of U.S. money disappeared because...
Oh, I don't mean disappeared, but spent. We're certainly in that realm.
Yes. I mean, war is very expensive. I mean, especially in terms of transport, of what it has taken to get our military and our resources halfway around the world is a very expensive enterprise.
Of course, Mike's right. That money doesn't go nowhere. There are people providing those services, being paid for them. Zanny Mittenbettos, what about the risk of the U.S. being dragged back in? We're still going to have lots of forces in this region, some just over the border in Kuwait. Our caller in South Carolina asks about private contractors still inside the borders of Iraq. Do you see a dragback risk here of significance, Zanny?
Well, I think there's certainly a possibility that a lot of that starting early next year there are going to be talks about perhaps some more troops coming back. But I think the bigger question is what happens in the region, and if the region is unstable, seriously unstable, then I'm very sure that there will be at some point a lot of discussion about where more U.S. troops are needed. This is a country that is whose future is enormously uncertain, whose security is very, very precarious and frankly not at all settled yet. So I think it's just a very big question mark what's going to happen in Iraq.
Let's bring it right back to the GOP back and forth this week, debates in Iowa, and more than that, barbs between Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich. On Fox News Monday, Romney said Gingrich should return the $1.6 million or so in consulting fees he received from Freddie Mac. At a campaign event in New Hampshire, Newt Gingrich here shot back.
I would just say that if Governor Romney would like to give back all the money he's earned from bankrupting companies and laying off employees over his years at Bain, that I would be glad to then listen to him. And I'll bet you $10, not $10,000. that he won't take the offer.
Jack, I couldn't quite believe my ears here. Here's a Republican candidate going after Mitt Romney with what one would expect to be a Democratic criticism that as is in his investment banking and private equity work. You know, he went in and cut companies, and sometimes maybe there were bankruptcies. Isn't that what the free market is supposed to do? Isn't that what Mitt Romney, in some sense, brags on, that he strengthened things by coming in and taking an axe to what needed to go?
That is his claim, and the Romney campaign has now produced a video from last year, which has Newt Gingrich saying of Mitt Romney, quote, he created more jobs than the entire Obama cabinet combined in his business career. So just a year ago, Newt was saying Mitt has created all these jobs. Now, of course, he's saying, oh, gosh, you know, he's a dark agent of creative destruction. You know, this is the problem with Newt, and this is what has finally driven what the Financial Times calls panic in conservative and GOP ranks, panic that he will be the nominee. Yesterday, the National Review came out with a slamming editorial on Newt saying, we have a chance, Republicans have a chance to win this election. If we nominate this man, we'll blow it. They attacked his, quote, impulsiveness, grandiosity, weakness for half-baked ideas, and said, Gingrich has always said he wants to transform the country. He appears unable to transform or even govern himself. This comes as there are signs, small but repeated around, that he has peaked. Polls showing him down in Iowa over the week. Another poll showing Mitt Romney ahead narrowly in Iowa. A sense that maybe GOP voters, as much as they like his ferocity and his forensic gifts on display last night, and how much they want to see him turn those on President Obama, are beginning to have perhaps second thoughts.
Republicans will decide, but it may be sometime in coming, that decision. Newt Gingrich criticized Romney's business record. We heard it there, accusing him of bankrupting companies. Here, last night in Iowa, moderator Chris Wallace put that critique to Governor Romney.
What do you think of what Speaker Gingrich had to say about you, and are you vulnerable to that kind of attack?
I think it's a great opportunity for us, because I think the president is going to level the same attack. He's going to go after me and say, you know, in businesses that you've invested in, they didn't all succeed. Some failed. Some laid people off. And he'll be absolutely right. But if you look at all the businesses we invested in, over 100 different businesses, they added tens of thousands of jobs.
And about the zany comment earlier in the week, at one point in the debate last night, Newt Gingrich paused before answering a question from Fox News moderator Neil Cavuto and responded instead to Mitt Romney's comment Wednesday about zaniness, the zany word.
You know, Neil, I sometimes get accused of using language that's too strong. So I've been standing here editing. I'm very concerned about not appearing to be zany.
Okay, zany. Let's talk zany. Do you see Newt Gingrich peaking this week, or still in strong motion?
Well, whether he's actually peaked this week or next week or the week after, I think at some point he's going to peak. I can't see him as the nominee, but I, you know, who knows? I think his attacks on Mitt Romney were kind of almost laughable for a Republican candidate. I mean, to be coming out saying that it was a, you know, a bad thing to be investing in companies if some of those companies laid off workers, I think Governor Romney had exactly the right response. You know, I hesitate. As someone who's often called zany by default, people don't realize I have an extra N. I don't have anything against zany people. But I do think zaniness is probably not a quality that you want in the president.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, comedian Stephen Colbert took a jab at Donald Trump's failed plans to host a GOP debate.
I can confirm that the Donald the Trump has pulled out of his own debate that all but two of the candidates had already pulled out of.
The National Transportation Safety Board is calling for a nationwide ban on cell phone use while driving. On Point callers, watch the road. Here's the NTSB chair, Deborah Hirschman.
No email, no text, no update, no call is worth a human life.
And Golden Globe Award nominations are out. The silent film, The Artist, leads with 6 nominations, including one for Best Original Score. sounds like a silent film. Susan Davis is with us today from USA Today's Zanny Minton-Beddoes from The Economist. Our own news analyst Jack Beatty is here. You can join us. Final thoughts on the Iraq war, the cost, the lessons, Iran. Final thoughts on Christopher Hitchens, the great acerbic voice gone. And why aren't Americans getting married? Does Time magazine have it right? The protester as person of the year? What are you thinking on Eric Holder, on Tim Tebow, on banning cell phone use in cars? Big, vivid Time magazine cover out with a protester on the front. Big kerchief over the mouth and hat over the head. Could be somewhere in North Africa. Could be in Egypt. Could be in New York or in the Occupy settings in the United States. On Wednesday, Time magazine managing editor Rick Stengel announced the person of the year on NBC's Today show. He explained that the Time had chosen the protester for the influence of protesters this year around the world and especially in the Middle East.
There was no movement there. We thought these dictators are not going to be toppled. And then these people who risked their lives, risked their livelihoods to go out there and brought about change that nobody had expected. It really is it's a transformational thing, and I think it is changing the world for the better.
Jack Beatty, could have been a lot of people on that magazine cover this year. Steve Jobs, we might have seen there. I mean, you name it. But it's the protester. What do you think of that, Jack?
Well, you know, it's a return to the past, really, back to the future. I mean, we saw this in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. Yes, right. We saw this in the 1960s where protesters changed history. They stopped a war. They helped to really transform this country, to return it to its vision in the civil rights movement. And now it's back, and it's back at a moment when politics everywhere seems to have been, you know, it'd be palsied, paralyzed, unable to act in Egypt under an ossified dictator,
yep.
In America under gridlock between the parties, and also basic issues of dignity and justice are being raised. We need to be paid attention to, these people said again and again in Egypt, and then again in Moscow. You heard people saying, we are not animals. We're people. Mm. We have rights. You've got to pay attention to us. And that seems to be the demand of the hour. We are people. What we want is important. Leaders, pay attention to us at your peril.
It is very hard to argue with Time magazine's choice, whether it's in Tahrir Square or Occupy Wall Street, you name it. A big impact this year. Everybody waiting to see whether that groundswell, and really in many settings around the world, whether and how and when it intersects with power and change, if it does. Chris in Buffalo, New York. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just want to make a statement about the way the Republican Party and the Democratic Party are going back and forth, exchanging barbs, when the real problems of the country are not being dealt with. When they're in positions of leadership, you're supposed to be the best and brightest in the country, and all they're doing is trying to score points with the media. I don't think that's going to do anything for the good of the country or for their long-term commitment to their careers. I just feel like it's a waste of time to put people in positions of power when they already have money, they already are used to having the influence, to go there and then try to exchange those things,
yep,
to get more for themselves.
Chris, we hear you. Chris, speak to Time magazine's accolade then for the protester. Do you see the protester is changing the calculus here, changing the equation, changing what's going on,
so,
Chris?
You know what? I think as far as the attention that it's getting, yeah, it will, because that is what's going to get the attention of those people that we have elected to represent our interests, so-called. But yet and still, the money is what's going to matter in the end. When it comes down to how much money can you raise and how quickly can you raise it, that is what determines the balance of power when it comes to an election, where it's basically a popularity contest. How much television time can you buy?
Chris, we've got it.
Let me put up?
Yeah, let me put it to Susan Davis. Susan, take the Time magazine, Person of the Year, the protester. You're on Capitol Hill. You see them negotiating and working and squirming week in and week out. Do they feel the hot breath of the protester right there where policy's being made or not?
I would say no, not really. In the sense, I don't think you can really compare the protests that went around the world this year to I think the closest thing we probably have in Washington is the Occupy Wall Street movement that has set up encampments throughout the city.
Mm-hmm.
But to the extent that I think that they have rattled the institution, I'm not sure it's there yet. I'm not sure it's reached a pitch. I'm not sure the protests here have been as coherent or as had an explicit an agenda as some of the protests around the world have had. But the caller, I think, does raise a good point about frustration and towards Washington and toward, generally speaking, in America. I don't know if Americans tend to protest in the same way in the modern world as we've seen around the world in the Middle East. But I think it explains why there's such low public opinion of our institutions, both of the president, of Congress. Right now, Congress is at historic lows of dissatisfaction among the American people. And that, I think, is reflective of sort of this broader the protester sentiment, that the confidence in what were once popular or stable institutions has been shaken.
Let's go to Roy in Somerset, Kentucky. Roy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about Christopher Hitchens. I think we lost a visionary, especially for the atheist and secular movement. If it wasn't for reading his books, I wouldn't have had the actual, gall to come out and just speak my mind and tell people that I'm not a believer in religion. And I look around at today, especially the political climate, and religion plays such a large factor in our politics, and we've lost a great, great debater.
No question about it, Christopher Hitchens. Whether you agreed with him or not, he really made a person think. There is no question about it. I once moderated a debate between Christopher Hitchens and a very prominent rabbi on religion and God, and you know how tough he was on those things. And both sides made their points, but Christopher Hitchens always made a person think. Cancer took him down this week. In 2007, he joined us right here, Roy, on this show to talk about his atheism, the nature of religion. Here's the now late Christopher Hitchens.
I think any even small dose of the sleep of reason, even when reason nods off for a second, unreason and barbarism are waiting to rush in. It's a full-time job just keeping the mind alive in the face of these challenges from superstition and irrationality.
Christopher Hitchens, 2 or 3 years ago. Zanny Mittenbeddoes, last thoughts on Christopher Hitchens. His tone may not be as uncommon where you grew up as it was here, Zanny, but he sure made an impression in this country.
That may be true, but he was an extraordinary man. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant debater, brilliant writer, delight to read, delight to listen to. He was an absolutely extraordinary individual. I would say one of Britain's greatest contemporary exports.
And finally, straight into the heart of the U.S. debate. Jack, thoughts on Christopher Hitchens?
Well, you know, he was a throwback as a writer to the William Hazlitts, to the pamphleteers of earlier days in England. And people use the word rhetoric as if it's mere rhetoric. Well, he was a master of it, of timing, of pitch, of the right epithet, of the occasional adverb, of voice in writing. And I think any young writer could go to school with profit on what he wrote.
Let me go to Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Well, thank you. I think I watched the debate last night.
The GOP debate in Iowa. Yeah, the last
GOP
one.
GOP last night from I'm shocked and stunned that these people still are beating the war drum. There's only one candidate on the stage, Ron Paul, bless his heart, standing there looking into the camera, looking into those faces in that arena where they were at, and was like, no, we can't do this anymore. We did this with Iraq. It was a disaster. It was a failure of monumental proportions. This would hang over the Bush administration and the hawks on the right for a very long time. But for some reason, the people that want to be president of the United States, they don't get the mistake that was made for a decade. We went into Iraq because of a lie. And we could sugarcoat it and say they thought this. No,
yep.
They lied to us.
Yes, it was right there. It wasn't true. The great big reason, and we heard families greeting their returning soldiers on NPR this morning from Iraq, and parents, families saying the very same point you're making, even as they greeted their sons and daughters home. Susan Davis, if it comes to, there's been a lot of tough talk on Iran, it's true, on the GOP stage, but then President Obama has not exactly been retiring on this front as well. Is there enough daylight between President Obama and likely GOP challengers for this to be a real debate if it ends up in the middle of the campaign season, Susan?
The problem that the Republican presidential candidates have right now with Obama is that the real record of Obama is he is not the liberal when it comes to war and foreign policy that Republicans thought he was going to be. He has extended in many ways the policies of George W. Bush when it comes to Iraq and Afghanistan, the Patriot Act, the defense bill that they approved this week on that it strengthens the detainees and military policy. So I think when you see in Republican primaries, they are attempting to draw that contrast that they need to get to the right of President Obama. So as the caller says, I think sometimes the rhetoric can be further to the right, but that is the nature of the primary system, is you have to sort of claim the conservative mantle. On Ron Paul, I would say, I am not directly covering the presidential race, but my colleagues that are out there, sure, people I talk to on the ground, it is not out of the realm of possibility that Ron Paul could have a strong foothold in Iowa this year. And it's a testament to both the divisions within the Republican primary, but that his position on foreign policy in the war has a foothold in the Republican Party. The Republican Party is not as hawkish across the line as it was. And I think the Iraq War and Afghanistan has sort of shaken that monolithic ideology in the party. There are doubters, and Ron Paul is emblematic.
Giving voice.
Of that.
He was saying in Iowa last night in the debate, Ron Paul said, "I emphasize a pro-American foreign policy," which he said is a lot different from policemen of the world. Carolyn in Iowa City, Iowa. Carolyn, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
About cell phoning and texting and driving with our families on the road, I'm just suggesting the smallest beep and honk possible so as not to incite road rage.
You mean if you see somebody texting, honk at them? Is that what you're suggesting?
Honk at them, uh-huh.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. It's going to be mayhem out there. Do you think that they'll be able to put that genie back in the bottle, ever able to stop that texting, talking on cell phones and cars? Is that in the cards?
As polite as possible, you know, just to get their attention.
Yeah, well, it's on the table now. We'll see where it goes. In most states, there are not many restrictions on this, but the clear call from those who look at the statistics, and every driver ought to be just thinking about this, more accidents when that's going on. Carolyn, I appreciate your call. Larry in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Larry, you're on the air.
Yes. I am a ordained minister, and I primarily function as a wedding officiant.
Okay.
And I am probably one of about 15 different wedding officiants who really put themselves out there and, you know, do a lot of work. And I don't know about the other 14, but myself, I've done 120 weddings so far this year, and I have about 5 more to do until the end of the year.
Larry, maybe you're just really good at it. Maybe everybody who's getting married is coming to you. Maybe you've got a glow.
Well, I will take that. Thank you. I am, and I'm passionate about it, but I just don't see where they're saying that less people are getting married. Well, I just don't.
Larry, we got it, and you're right there on the front line, so we take that. We take it seriously. On the other hand, here's the news story that made the headlines. This is from the Pew Research Center. A big report, a survey showing the current number of married adults in this country has dropped to a record low of 51%. For perspective, back in 1960, it was 72% of U.S. adults age 18 and older were married. Now, 51% by current trends. Married people will be a minority soon. Why? Connor, Somerville, Massachusetts. Connor, you're on the air.
I actually think it's a direct result of advertising. If you look at ads from the 60s, anything from a car ad to a can of soup showed a married couple and a happy family. But I think somewhere between then and now, ad execs realized that a single consumer spends a lot more money than a married one who tends to save or spend it on their child's education or necessities rather than just random consumables.
So it's Madison Avenue again, stealing marriage from us, just showing happy, smiling single people. You may be right. We're going to follow that trend, keep an eye on it. Jack Beatty, really interesting this week, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, he has been under a lot of fire lately, but he came out this week saying he's concerned about laws emerging that restrict access to voting, passed recently in several states. Interesting here, he talked at the Lyndon B. Johnson Presidential Library in Austin, Texas, on Tuesday. Let's listen. Here's Attorney General Eric Holder.
In 1965, when President Johnson signed the landmark Voting Rights Act into law, he proclaimed, and I quote, "The right to vote is the basic right without which all others are meaningless," unquote. Today, as Attorney General, I have the privilege and the solemn duty of enforcing this law and the other civil rights reforms that President Johnson championed. Now, this work is among the Justice Department's most important priorities.
Jack Beatty, this is big on the eve of a big election year. A top priority for the Justice Department. And what's he suggesting here, Jack?
Well, for one thing, the Justice Department is going to look very carefully at the states that are covered under the Voting Rights Act, 12, I think, now, that have passed restrictive legislation. Is this discriminatory? And they're going to take cases to court, they say. And second, he made a very bold proposal. He said, you know, we really ought to do what other governments do, what European governments do, what they do in Australia, which is the government should register voters. As a matter of citizenship, the government will register
instead
you.
Of waiting for instead them to come
of,
in and do
instead,
it.
Instead of going into the line
kind of
and
automatic.
Taking the day
yeah.
off.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Take wow. that hurdle away
that
and just
things.
Automatic registration. It won't happen soon, but that's an idea on the horizon.
Watch this space. That will be big in an election year. Zanny Mittenbettos, have you been watching the ticker while we're on the air? Is Europe still there, Zanny?
I think Europe is still there.
Well, for how long?
For how long? Well, we'll see. We'll be able to discuss that next year. But one thing I can tell you for certain is that the euro crisis is not going to go away.
There will always be an England, or I suppose there will always be a Europe, but the euro, who knows? We will watch with some fear and trembling. Zanny Mittenbettos, economics editor of The Economist. It's always terrific to have you. Thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Susan Davis, chief congressional reporter for USA Today. We still know those three letters. Susan, thank you for being here. You're great.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Jack Beatty, have a great weekend. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And listeners, same to you. Have a great weekend coming right up on the holidays here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.